and this is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's just early December, but debates are already cropping up over what some call the war on Christmas. One of the latest examples is in New England, where Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee recently decided to light what he called a holiday tree outside the State House. That word choice got him in trouble with some Ocean Staters, who saw it as yet another move to secularize a religious holiday. But in a contentious interview with Fox News, Chafee referred to Rhode Island's history as a cradle of religious liberty, and that the state's founder, Roger Williams, established the colony for those escaping harsh Puritan rule and a separation of church and state. While these references to the state's religious past didn't cool the war on Christmas concerns, they did serve as a reminder of just how long we've been having this argument over separation of church and state. And it doesn't just come up around holiday time. Here in New Hampshire, we've seen renewed debate over these issues. For example, whether employers should have to pay for contraception coverage, even if doing so violates their beliefs, or whether any part of church-owned buildings should be subject to local property taxes. Today in The Exchange, freedom of religion, the separation of church and state, and why we're still struggling to figure this out. Let's hear from you. Where do you come down on this issue? Do you see problems with both a complete separation between church and state, or with the binding of the two? How have you seen the nation evolve around this idea? What are your thoughts? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. With me in studio is Barry Lynn, Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, an organization dedicated to preserving the Constitution's religious liberty provisions. He is in the state to speak at the New Hampshire Civil Liberty Union's annual Bill of Rights dinner, which was last night. And Barry Lynn, nice to meet you and welcome to New Hampshire.
It's very nice to be here.
And also joining us in just a couple minutes from Texas will be Hiram Sasser, Director of Litigation for Liberty Institute, a nonprofit law firm dedicated to defending and restoring religious liberty across America. And he'll be joining us in just a moment. Barry, I do want to start with you just philosophically before we get into all the examples that are out there, including some of the ones I mentioned. Why are we still having this national argument over separation of church and state after the founders spoke about this 200 plus years ago?
I think we're still having the fight and the argument because this issue of religion, even in so many cases for people who are not religious, is the biggest single thing that they think about. It is their whole life. For a religious person, I talk to a lot of people who say, I'm religious 24/7, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which means they're dreaming about religion, and maybe they literally are. But they see themselves as having all the answers based on whatever their religion is. In this country, mainly a Christianity at this point. It may change in the future, but it's Christianity now. And they think if they have all the answers from their own interpretation of the Bible, why shouldn't the rest of us accept those truths? And if we won't accept them voluntarily, maybe, they say, maybe we should get the government at the state level or the federal level to come in and impose those beliefs on us, because then we'll all be right and we'll all get to heaven.
Do you ever sit back, Barry, and think, I wish those founders had been a little more clear?
They could have been clear. You know, one of the fights that frequently goes on among historians is what did the framers of the Constitution really mean when they said in 16 words, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Those are the first 16 words of the First Amendment. What did it mean? We do know that they had other formulations like Congress shall establish no national religion. That was very specific, but it was rejected. They wanted a more expansive view, and that's why we get the 16 words. You know, I say to law students all the time, if you pick the right 16 words, you can build an entire career out of it, just like I have over the separation of church and state.
Well, and Hiram Sasser is with us again, Director of Litigation for Liberty Institute. He joins us from Texas. And Hiram, what do you think? Why do you think we're still having this fight over church and state and government and the separation thereof?
Well, I think the reason we did not have a fight for the first 150 years is because of this country's existence. Because I think most people in America understood how religious liberty worked in this country, that everyone has a right to practice a religion in the way they see fit. The government's not going to interfere with those religious practices unless they are going to cause some sort of massive social or safety issue or something of that nature, some big, major, compelling governmental interest. And I think that all the sort of local things of having memorials that happen to have religious imagery, and having in Washington D.C. in front of the federal courthouse, having Christopher Columbus kneeling down praying in front of a cross, it's still there. All those sorts of things that were done, I just don't think people thought for 150 years that that violated the Constitution. And I think that was closer to, what our founding fathers believed, which is we're not going to coerce people into believing certain things, but religious imagery on obscure monuments is going to be okay, for example, and other things like that. So I think it's just been in the past 50 years when people wanted to reinterpret and say, well, this stuff means something different now, and we want to read something into it that wasn't there before, is why we're having our fights today.
Well, why do you suppose that's the case then? What changed, Hiram, in your opinion?
Well, I think what changed was a lot of people in the 50s and 60s, assumed that the legislature was the way change happened, that people would vote in change if they wanted it. But there were a handful of people who came along who said, I think we can, through court cases, get unelected judges to sort of decide some of these issues for the people, not having the people's collective will exercise, but rather just sort of have judges decide these issues. And so in the 50s and 60s, especially in the 60s, we saw litigation arise from newly formed groups to try to undo or redo what they believed were wrongs for 150 years, and that's what we have going on.
So here's what the First Amendment says, and I think it's important to just put it out there right now. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Real quickly, Hiram, because I asked Barry this too, what do you think? Could the founders have made it a little more clear for us?
Well, I think they chose eloquent language. And I'm really glad that it's short, and that we didn't get too specific, because then we would all fight over the edges of that specificity. In other words, there's no level of specificity that would satisfy everyone all the time. But I think what's a better guide is what were the founding fathers in the immediate succeeding generations doing in light of that language. And were there any challenges at the time to what they were doing? Did anyone raise any protests? So when Congress passed a bill to fund the printing of Bibles to be used in our nation's schools, was that constitutional or not? Well, there wasn't even any real debate or discussion about that. And so if Congress today wanted to use public money to print Bibles, it would be hard-pressed for someone to say that that's what the founding fathers would have prohibited that when they, in fact, actually did it.
Wow. That'd be a hard sell, though, today, Barry, wouldn't it?
No, it'd be a very hard sell. And, of course, frankly, throughout history, there have been people who are deeply concerned about these issues. And until it became clear in the 1930s that the Supreme Court said, yeah, individuals can sue to remedy abridgments of individual freedoms. I mean, Hiram's right. We didn't know we could file those lawsuits, but of course we could, and laws had been declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court as early as 1790. But, it was remarkable during the Civil War period, speaking of this golden age that Hiram thinks was out there, there was the so-called Bible riots in Philadelphia. This was a place where over which version of the Bible to read in Pennsylvania public schools, the Catholic version or the Protestant version, churches were burned to the ground, people were killed. And then after the Civil War, when President Ulysses S. Grant was president, Catholics said, we would like to have private schools, and we would like them subsidized. And Grant said, look, the issue here should be we should get the Protestant religion out of public schools, and then we shouldn't also, by the way, subsidize Catholic schools. Schools should be neutral on the question of religion. That was Grant. That wasn't 50 years ago. That was post-Civil War. So we've been having these battles. And then there were silent people, the people who were being persecuted, people who were made to feel like second-class citizens who had no remedy until the 1930s when the courts began to recognize individual rights to get into court and vindicate your freedoms.
Well, and you bringing up Catholic versus Protestant and the fight over the schools there. A question for you, Hiram, and I know this has come up a lot lately. Religious diversity is growing a lot more broadly and more rapidly than just Catholic versus Protestant. Today, we've got growing numbers of Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus. So how does that, Hiram, complicate ideas of religious freedom? I mean, whose religion are we talking about? How hard is it to include everybody?
Well, I think Justice Joseph Story, one of our first Supreme Court justices of the United States, and his commentaries on the Constitution that he wrote in 1820 really shed some light on this, in which he said that he named many of those many of the faiths that you wouldn't have thought that a founding father or errant person would be thinking of, but Muslims and various others named them. And said that religious liberty belongs to everybody. Everybody has the right to exercise their religious beliefs, and the government should not be getting involved in that. But that also does not mean, and I'm paraphrasing Joseph Story now, but Justice Story said that does not mean that the government cannot do things that have a benefit to religion or any particular religion in general. And so there's a balance there that everyone has to have the right to free exercise. But just because the governor puts up a Christmas tree doesn't violate somebody's religious liberty.
All right. Lots more of follow-ups to that after a short break. And we will start taking your calls, too. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. We'll take your emails at exchange@nhpr.org, or you can share your comments on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. We'll be back in just a minute.
This is NHPR. It's 9:19. Good morning. NHPR's 12 Days of Drawings kicks off today with four tickets to A Christmas Carol at the Palace Theater in Manchester. When you make a tax-deductible donation today, you'll be automatically entered into today's drawing and every other drawing we do in the next 12 days. Make your gift at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Unity Homes from Bensonwood, designed to improve the world by enhancing quality of life and reducing energy consumption. Information at unityhomes.com. From the Elliott at River's Edge Outpatient Care Facility in downtown Manchester, providing lab x-rays, CT scans, open MRI, physical and occupational therapy, and more, ElliottRiversEdge.org. And Burke Jewelers in Nashua, a family company spanning four generations and 103 years, specializing in custom jewelry design, fine estate jewelry, and repair, 89 West Pearl Street in Nashua. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at this idea of the separation of church and state and how it keeps coming up, especially in today's debates over religious liberty. We're exploring these concepts, and we'd like to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Where do you come down on this subject? Do you see problems with both a total and complete separation between church and state, or the binding of the two? How have you seen our national conversation change around this idea? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. Barry Lynn is with us in studio, Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. From Texas, Hiram Sasser, Director of Litigation for Liberty Institute. And Barry, just before the break, I was asking Hiram about this idea of religious diversity in America today. And boy, it's so different from even 20, 30 years ago. We have so many different religions. Some of them growing, the number of Muslims growing very quickly, for example. So how do you accommodate everybody in this environment?
You know, at some point you can't accommodate everyone if what everyone wants to do is impinge upon the rights of some of those other people. 2,000 identifiable religions in this country, 20 to 25 million non-believers in this country.
Wait, 2,000?
Yeah, different identifiable religious groups, all with different doctrines. You know, Christianity does not all come in one flavor, in one form. So we have to deal with diversity, but we have to also recognize that when people say, I am of religion A, and I want to be exempted from some of the laws of the country because I don't, they're inconsistent with my theology, that then religion B will say, claim the same exemption and religion C a different set of exemptions. And finally, you have a splintering of everything from social programs to health care to anything that becomes a national program. And that's where the fight is, as you alluded to, over, say, contraceptive coverage in the President's Affordable Care Act. I mean, can you accommodate the insistence by religious employers, a Roman Catholic who owns an air conditioning company, for example, who doesn't want to cover his employees for birth control? Or does that open a Pandora's box where the next week somebody who's a Jehovah's Witness says, you know, I'm not covering surgery for my employees because I don't believe in the use of whole blood projects. And the Scientologists say, I'm not sending anybody to a psychiatrist because I don't believe in psychiatry. You literally can't allow everyone to exempt themselves from the laws of general applicability and run a country as gigantic and as diverse as this one.
Well, and I definitely want to get into the contraception debate, but more broadly for just a minute, and to you, Hiram, again, on this issue of religious diversity. As you know, there are some religions that have ideas that are very different from the mainstream Judeo-Christian model that we're so used to here in this country. For example, in some Muslim cultures, you know, women are not allowed to do certain things. I'd love more of your thoughts on just how tough it can be to accommodate the expression of everybody. What do you think, Hiram?
Well, I think when you have government being looked at to provide more and more solutions and more control over everybody's individual lives, that's what actually gives rise to these to this new debate. The people of faith aren't changing what they're doing. Government's changing how much they want to regulate everybody. But given that, you know, I think that it's I think we have to be careful to be judgmental about people of faith, no matter what faith that they're expressing, because you know, what we don't want is we don't want the government coming in and saying some people's faith is okay and some people's faith is not okay. We certainly don't want the government coming in and saying that certain faiths are so popular that we're going to give them exemptions, but we're not going to give exemptions to unpopular faiths. We live in a pluralistic country, and religious liberty belongs to everybody. And the only way that our freedom is going to work is that we have to have respect and acknowledgement that our other fellow Americans deserve the same level and measure of religious liberty as everyone else.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So since you brought it up, Barry Lynn, let's dive into the contraception coverage, because that did raise this issue again. And of course, now we have questions of separation and church and state around holiday celebrations or Christmas celebrations. But let's talk about the contraception coverage. This question of whether employers whose religion tells them contraception is wrong, Catholic bishops especially, have called this an attack on religious liberty. And Barry, I do wonder, it's not as if, this is what the bishops say, it's not as if the government, it's not as if they are saying to female employees, you can't have contraception, it's just, I don't want to pay for it. So it's not that they're denying contraception, they're just saying, I don't want to put my dollars towards that.
Well, to some degree, they are denying it, because contraceptives are not only the things you buy, you know, on the rack off the counter at the drugstore. Some individuals need far more expensive contraceptive medical assistance. So let's leave the money aside just for a moment. What the Catholic Church is saying is we have a corporate conscience. And in fact, if we have an employer, this is a real story, an air conditioning company in the state of Colorado that has a Catholic owner who said, I'm not going to cover contraceptives. And the position of the Catholic bishops is he has a right to determine for all of his employees what conscience they will be allowed effectively in this system of comprehensive health care, more or less comprehensive health care, what judgments as a moral matter those employees will be willing to make. There have been five cases like this. Three judges have bought into what I suspect is Hiram's idea of a kind of a corporate conscience for institutions, nonprofits, as well as for-profit organizations. But the other two judges have said, no, of course not. This is very attenuated. Here's what the Obama administration, I think, in 2 months is going to announce. They're going to announce if you don't want to cover your employees with contraceptive coverage, just have to give them a piece of paper when you employ them. Say, call this 800 number. It's a third-party provider. We're not going to provide it, but this is who will do it for free. The bishops have already announced that is unacceptable. That is contributing to sin. This simple administrative act of handing out a phone number is considered, as one of the witnesses at a hearing I testified at this summer said, it's like forcing a rabbi to eat pork. No, it is not. It is not like forcing a rabbi to eat pork to pass to an employee or to a student at a Catholic-run university a phone number that says, we're not covering, we don't even want you to take contraceptives unless you are married, but here's the person that will do it if you want it.
But you are facilitating that coverage.
Well,
facilitating, by giving that information
in the most trivial fashion. There is a concept, I hate to speak Latin even on NPR, but I will, de minimis. In other words, things that are so trivial that they don't constitute a real claim of rights. That, passing a piece of paper, telling them where to get a third party, to me, that's de minimis. That is not an intrusion.
Well,
and by
no,
the way, corporations don't have
Hang on, Hiram. I want to let him finish, and then I definitely want to hear from you. Go ahead,
by the way,
finish.
I don't think corporations have a conscience. I don't mean that in a backhanded slap at corporations. I mean that this is not a concept that the law ought to recognize.
Okay, go ahead, Hiram, and then I've got another question for both of you on the so-called war on Christmas. Go ahead, Hiram.
Well, sure. I think that Barry is really hitting the heart of the matter. He's calling this the beliefs of the Catholic Church that they don't want to participate in something. He's saying, well, that's really de minimis. That's really a theological position. And what Barry wants to do in this situation is he wants to impose his theological position on the Catholic Church, that this is really not that big of a deal. If they believe that it, from their faith perspective, that it is a big deal, that it is the same as asking a Jewish person to eat pork or to buy pork or whatever it may be, then I would think Barry, of all people, would be honoring of that. What I don't really understand also is why Barry's organization would take this position, given that the government mandating that religious organizations provide certain things to their employees, I would think that's the government getting involved in internal church affairs and taking sides on theological disputes. I can't imagine that Thomas Jefferson, in his letter to the Danbury Baptist that he wrote, in which the famous phrase "wall of separation of church and state." I mean, I could read that later on, the language from that letter, but basically it was about not the government shouldn't be getting involved and intruding in the internal affairs and theological decisions of the church. So I don't understand why Barry thinks it's appropriate to have the government, the strong arm of the government, coming in and reaching into church coffers and telling them how to spend their money.
Can you address also what Barry said earlier, Hiram, this idea of a splintering? You know, where do you manage to accommodate the ideas of Scientologists and Muslims and Jews and Christians and Buddhists and Hindus and the 2,000 religions that we have? What about the example that he gives, Hiram, of, you know, this employer doesn't want to do contraception, this employer doesn't believe in, you know, certain types of medical treatment, this employer doesn't believe, on a religious basis, in psychiatric treatment? I just wonder where you pull the tent down over the camel's nose, so to speak.
Well, sure. Well, here's what we're talking about. We're talking about people who have a shared faith or are being employed by an employer with a very specific faith. And whether or not those particular employees will be able to require of their religious employers certain types of coverage that religious employers do not want to provide and are upfront about not wanting to provide. It's really no different than any other job requirement. You'll have to lift 50 pounds, or this company uses overseas manufacturing, and you may be a made in the USA person. In other words, there are lots of reasons why someone may disagree with the decisions and the business decisions of their particular employer, but that doesn't, I don't think anyone in a different context would think that they could require of their employer certain actions and beliefs about those things. Now, I think that providing accommodation for people of faith is a good thing. I don't think that we should cut off people because they're a minority faith. I think people of a very small, limited faith, the impact that they will overall have is very little anyway on the overall scheme. So I have no idea why Barry would be for telling these small religious practitioners of obscure faith that they're not going to have any accommodation either.
Yeah, it's tricky. And again, as we talk about private businesses versus government, what about both of you, real quickly, Hiram, you first. So if I'm an employer and I have a devoutly Jewish employee and he wants to take, a couple days off around Yom Kippur, should he have to take vacation days, or are those holidays? Because my employees get Christmas off for free, so to speak. So should my Jewish employee get Rosh Hashanah off for free?
Well, I think the answer to that certainly depends on the nature of the business. If there's no impact on the business at all, or the impact is really negligible, then I don't know. I would think they might be required under Title VII to provide that measure of accommodation. They would have to provide the same level of accommodation that they would certainly provide any other person of faith. And so if Christmas Day is off, I wouldn't see any reason why the employer would not provide Yom Kippur off, for example.
Barry, then we'll go to our callers.
Yeah, accommodation of employee religious issues is one thing. We're kind of looking earlier at the flip side of that. What if it is the employer who makes the rules, and the rules are all made on the basis of religion? And that's where I think we simply can't accommodate. You cannot run a railroad. You can't run a comprehensive health care system. You can't run Social Security. The Amish said this, went to the Supreme Court. We don't care if our employees are Amish. We don't want to participate in Social Security. We're not giving the government any information. The Supreme Court said, I'm sorry, but you have to, because the system requires nearly full participation. And I
otherwise,
think that's
it breaks
the same
down?
Case here. Otherwise, it breaks down. It doesn't do what it was supposed to do.
All right. Let's get our callers involved, gentlemen. 1-800-892-6477. Join us today in The Exchange. We're looking once again at the church and state debate and the First Amendment's ideas of religious liberty. We're looking at just what we mean by separation of church and state, where this comes from, and why we're still struggling with this today. We're hearing some examples right now. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Up first is Janet in Concord. Hi, Janet. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Janet, are you with us?
Yes.
Hi. Go ahead, Janet, please. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. I know you just touched on holidays, but I am Jewish, and I know, I went to public high school where I was forced to take Christmas off, but had to take an absence for Jewish holidays, and I've worked for the state of New Hampshire, and the same holds true. And, I would have to use personal days or vacation days to take my holidays off. So I'm wondering why they don't just give more personal days and let people choose when they take a holiday off. I would go in and volunteer on Christmas Day, because it really didn't matter to me whether, to be home, because it's not a holiday I celebrate. So.
Yeah, so a little more flexibility. You could count that holiday day towards your holiday, Janet, and give some people a break on Christmas if they had to be.
Yeah, and I'm wondering why the state can mandate people to take off religiously based holidays and force them, if it's not their holiday, to take that as a personal or vacation day.
Yeah.
And I'll take their comments off the air.
Okay, Janet, thanks a lot for calling in. Barry, go ahead.
Yeah, actually, at Americans United for Separation of Church and State, we've had employees who are non-Christian who have asked precisely what Janet wants, and we've always been able to accommodate them. So they will come in and work on December 25th or whatever is the Christmas celebration day, and then they will take another personal day off for their own expression of belief. Or in one case, I remember a fellow had no religious beliefs, and I think he just took off on some alternate Tuesday. But no, that's the kind of sensible accommodation that people in and out of government ought to be able to achieve. Question is whether if you define religion in one very specific way, whether you're going to be able to impose that on all of your employees, even if you're a for-profit company. Catholic Church says yes. Evangelicals in the Protestant religious right say yes, but people in the civil liberties world say no, you don't have the right to claim a corporate conscience that overrides the conscience of the individual employee.
Well, and since you mentioned one of your employees who has no religious beliefs, it raises a question I wanted to ask both of you gentlemen, and I'll turn to you first, I think, Hiram. People studying religious trends in this country have noted that one of the fastest growing groups is those that Barry mentioned, people with no religious faith at all. How do you see that, Hiram, affecting our ideas around separation of church and state, given that this is one of the fastest growing religious groups, is those of no religion at all?
Yeah, well, I don't think that there were probably ever any time in our country where there was someone where there were no people of no faith. I mean, I think we've always there's always been a broad diversity in America since its founding, and I think that one of the things that that makes America great is that through that diversity we have been able to respect one another and also work together for the common good. I think what Janet was talking about was a fantastic idea, and I think that people of faith or no faith need to pull together and have mutual respect and understanding for each other. What I find very disturbing is, I'll give you another example, that one of the things that I've always wondered why Barry Lynn does this is that he kind of goes around during the election season trying to turn churches into the IRS if he thinks that they've said too much in favor of one candidate or another. There's no constitutional reason why he's doing that. It's just an obscure 1954 law that suddenly changed the dynamic and said that that churches are not allowed to endorse candidates one way or the other, or they risk losing their tax exempt status. I guess what I've never understood is why he believes separation of church and state is achieved by turning churches into the government so that the government can then investigate and monitor the activities and speech of churches. I've never understood how that separation. I would have thought he would have been on the opposite side of that issue.
Well, taxing churches is certainly another area where this separation of church and state comes up a lot. So we'll talk about that after a short break and take more of your calls to the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. More of your thoughts coming up.
This is NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from the Boston Pops Holiday Concert, December 15th at the Verizon Wireless Arena, conducted by Keith Lockhart with sing-alongs and Christmas classics. Tickets at Ticketmaster.com. And from Tarm Biomass and Lime, supplying high-efficiency wood and wood pellet heating for homes and commercial applications while encouraging the use of local renewable fuel sources. Woodboilers.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
NHPR has logged a lot of miles this year, from the Northern Pass Project, the hepatitis outbreak at Exeter Hospital, to tracking candidates ahead of New Hampshire's many elections. Your old car has logged a lot of miles, too, as you've listened into our signature reporting. So, as the tax year winds down, consider taking advantage of our vehicle donation program. We'll take care of all the paperwork, pick up your car, and auction it off. All you need to do is call 1-877-393-NHPR or visit NHPR.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we sit down with four-term New Hampshire Governor John Lynch. Email us your questions that you'd like me to ask the governor before the program at exchange@nhpr.org. And then join us tomorrow for this special program, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the separation of church and state, the debate around religious liberty in America. We'd like to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Barry Lynn, Hiram Sasser, let's go back to our callers. Andrew's calling from Jackson. Hi, Andrew. Thanks for waiting. You're on The Exchange.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. It occurs to me that we're banging our head against the wall and then asking what to do about the headache. We have holidays that have been officially recognized by the state in therefore raising one religion above the other, and minority religions then asking, what should we do about these holidays, and putting the onus on the employer to make those decisions. It's precisely for that reason that the state should not be recognizing one religion above the other and allowing each religion to practice freely. This extends to the healthcare issue, where we now have a state-sponsored healthcare mandate, which is requiring religions and people of faith to make decisions that violate those faiths. The state and religion needs to be separated to protect individuals' rights and individuals' freedoms to practice their religion. Seems to me the problem is banging our head against the wall, not the headache that's occurring from it.
So are you suggesting what Hiram suggested, Andrew, that if the government just pulled back in general, we wouldn't have these problems? Is that what you're saying?
I believe that the government has no place in sanctioning one religion over another, and that road leads to very, very dangerous outcomes. And we wouldn't have the problem with the having to make special phone numbers for people to call if they don't get contraception from their employer because their faith won't allow them to do it, if the government wasn't in the business of forcing health care on people and the government wasn't in the business of recognizing Christian religions over Jewish religions, Muslims, Zoroastrians, whatever you want. The government has no place in those issues. And we would not have these problems in the first place.
So should Christmas be a federal holiday, Andrew, or should it be sort of at the discretion?
Well, I think at this point we've got no place where Christmas has become a secular holiday. The selling of toys and the constant pushing of product, it ceases to be a religious holiday for most people. So now we have a secular holiday. My personal opinion is I would not have the state sponsor any holidays other than those that recognize the national holidays, 4th of July, Veterans Day, Memorial Day, President's Day. These are national holidays, not religious holidays.
Okay.
And allow religions to celebrate their own holidays. And if you want to give people the right to take any religious holiday they want off, fine. That's a separate issue. But these are the bugaboos that the Constitution was trying to avoid, by saying separate these two institutions so we don't have the problems coming up from this. I remember the whole discussion with Tebow praying during the games. I wondered always what would happen.
Okay. Andrew, I want to let you go. Yeah, I want to let you go. Lots of thoughts. And Barry Lynn, he's a purist. You know, he's saying, look, don't make people provide contraception coverage. Don't make people mm-hmm. give Christmas off. What do you think?
Well, you know, there is a federal law that says Christmas is a national holiday. And it's the kind of a basis for people like Bill O'Reilly on the Fox News channel to say, well, therefore, governments can promote anything at this time of year. And his notable fight with Governor Lincoln Chafee over the holiday bush or the Christmas tree last week on his TV show. It'd be good if we didn't have religious holidays identified as such by federal statute. On the other hand, what happens when people sue over this. The courts say, but isn't there a secular purpose that has developed, as Andrew said, for this particular December 25th? It's a time of family get-togethers and people give gifts. And so there's a secular purpose that has been encrusted over the religion, and that justifies it remaining as a federal holiday, whether you like that decision or not. I mean, that's kind of the way the courts go. But to Andrew and also to Hiram, there's another question. This idea, I get the sense that both of them are kind of libertarian-type people, but if you say, well, government should do nothing about religion, what about the couple, and there are these folks live all over the United States, including in New England, who say, look, my child is sick, has a very serious illness like cancer. I believe that my faith in God is so strong that if I pray and only use prayer, my child will be healed. Often the state comes in and says, wait a minute, you can believe that as a matter of religion. We're still taking your kid to the hospital.
These are the Christian scientists.
Right. Well, not just Christian scientists, but a lot of other people with less well-defined, institutionally well-defined beliefs who take that position. Does Hiram believe that the state should say, okay, that's your sincere religious belief. We're not going to force medicine on your child. do the praying, and good luck with that.
Well, and there's another example, and Hiram would definitely want to hear from you on this. Another example that feels a little similar, Hiram and Barry, is Mormons used to say that polygamy was okay, and then the federal government stepped in and said, no, you can't do that. What do you think, Hiram? There are these examples that come up in the news of Christian Scientists saying my religious belief does not allow my desperately ill child to be treated, and the state says, too bad, our interest is in saving this child.
Yeah, I think that our founding fathers have all had always contemplated, and indeed, as early I think it was in the 1870s when the polygamy question was the religious liberty polygamy question was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court regarding the Mormons in Utah, is that there are exceptions to religious liberty, and one of the exceptions are anything that's a compelling governmental interest, that life safety, for example, is a compelling governmental interest. And so in a life safety issue, to save the life of a child, the government can interfere with the religious beliefs. But for example, on the healthcare thing, the Supreme Court has said, and unanimously said so in UDV versus Gonzalez back in 2006, said that if the government provides exemptions to people and secular exemptions, then they have no compelling interest at all, and they cannot deny religious exemptions. This healthcare law, for example, is riddled with special exemptions for unions or special exemptions for this company or that company or this type of company or whatever. So to deny religious exemptions is frankly, it's laughable. And it's not like it's a split issue at the U.S. Supreme Court. It's a 9-0 issue. If you provide secular exemptions, you have to provide religious exemptions.
So compelling interest, the life of a child, Hiram.
Yes.
The state has a compelling interest. What about, I'm just playing with this here, some people could say, you know, I need contraception, and that's a compelling interest, so that I don't have an unintended pregnancy, I'm young, I'm in college, or whatever. Could you extend this compelling interest to the contraception debate?
No, I don't think so, because the statutes at issue, the entire act, that the Affordable Health Care Act, because it provides so many exemptions and exceptions for unions and other corporations that have favored status with the administration, because there's so many exceptions for the corporate buddies of the people who pass this thing, they cannot deny exemptions and exceptions to religious organizations.
Let's take another call if we could. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And to Hollis next, Jeffrey's on the air. Welcome, Jeffrey. Thanks for waiting.
You're very welcome. The point I want to make is about taxation in churches. It seems to me that granting churches and religious institutions tax-free status is actually a form of government subsidization of the church. And in fact, the people who are not churches are, in a sense, paying for those churches with those exemptions, in the same sense that we pay for exemptions for other industries, we say for exemptions for home ownership. So what we're seeing here is, in that deduction, is an intent of the government to encourage religious belief. And as such, I really think it probably would be more sensible if churches were taxed just as any other form of entertainment, just as part of the entertainment industry.
Entertainment? Except, wow.
Well, yes, yes.
Wow,
except for the charitable work. Well, if you think about it, other than the charitable work, the actual work that can be put down, this is charitable work that they are doing, that they're actually helping people. Most of the time, they're putting on shows and entertaining people.
What about other? Jeffrey, can I ask you a quick question? This is a really important question. I'm glad you called. What about other nonprofits? Should they also pay property taxes? We've done whole shows on this, but you know, homeless shelters, for example, should they have to pay property taxes?
No, because that's not providing people entertainment. That's actually helping people.
Okay.
I think the part that they're actually doing that would be helping people, like feeding people. Catholic Charities, for example, does a heck of a lot of good. That definitely should continue to be tax exempt. But the entertainment portion, the services, the dressing up in the fancy robes and the singing and the music and all that stuff, that's just entertainment.
All right, Barry, Jeffrey, I'm going to let you go. And it's a great question, but it just in the interest of time, and I know both our guests are going to want to jump in on this. First to you, Barry Lynn, should churches be tax exempt, or should they have to pay taxes, as our caller says?
Taxation of churches is a very complicated issue, and even among civil libertarians, there's a lot of difference of opinion. I agree with some of what Jeffrey said, although a group like Catholic Charities, by the way, that gets so heavily subsidized by the governments of both of states and the federal government, and then decides it wants to be exempt from certain civil rights laws in regard to hiring and that kind of stuff, that has no place. If you take government money, you have to play by the government's rules. That, to me, is not an imposition of a heavy hand of government. That's just saying everybody has to play by the same rules. So Catholic Charities may not be the best example, Jeffrey, for making your case. I understand where he's going, and one thing that I hope your listeners understand is the tax exemption for nonprofits, including churches, is not guaranteed by the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't guarantee that churches are tax exempt. It is a policy decision we made, and the only Supreme Court case on this matter has said, insofar as church tax exemptions are part of a broader range of exemptions for all kinds of educational and charitable purposes for secular and religious groups, it will be upheld. If it was standing alone, no court decision says you're guaranteed. That's why, to Hiram's point earlier in the show, we say the statute that says if you get a tax exemption means you cannot endorse candidates as any nonprofit. I can't. I'm a nonprofit. I don't go on TV announcing who you should vote for the United States Senate. That's a small price to pay for the extraordinarily valuable tax exemption that I get at Americans United and that every church in this country, except for the few who say, I don't want any tax exemption, I will pay taxes, but then let me alone. And I respect those decisions by so-called free churches.
So you're saying tax exemption is okay as long as you don't engage in political
endorsements? No partisan political endorsements. That's the only serious impediment to what you can do with your tax exemption, a small price to pay if you violate it, Democrat or Republican. If we get evidence about that, we do report that to the Internal Revenue Service for their very slow, I should say, investigation of these cases.
Well, and Hiram, you talked about the sort of politics in the pulpit before, but what about Jeffrey's question that churches shouldn't get tax exemptions for the part of their operations that he calls entertainment? They should only get the tax exemption for running the soup kitchen or the homeless shelter. What do you think, Hiram?
Well, I think the first concept to understand is the power to tax is the power to destroy. And I was really shocked to hear Barry Lynn say anything positive at all towards even hinting at something positive towards the concept of the government taxing a church. If there's anything Americans United for Separation of Church and State should stand for, it should be that the government shouldn't be taxing churches. Here's what I say is that everybody's entitled to their opinion and to their religious beliefs and their practice. Jeffrey believes that the religious activities that are going on in church are for entertainment purposes, but there are millions of other people who believe quite strongly that those religious services are a core central part of their being, and that they couldn't make it to the next day without their participation in those services. So I think the better way is that to each his own. Everybody has their religious faith or non-faith as they see fit, and the government should stay out of taking sides and forcing religious organizations to violate their conscience and simply allow religious liberty to flourish free from government interference and oversight.
Here's an email too, Andrew. This goes along with what you were saying, from Russ, who says religion should hold no special place in American life. Church and state must be separate. Churches and or religion should be taxed. So there you go, Jeffrey, and thanks a lot for calling in. Gentlemen, we're almost out of time, but just a quick thought from you, and I think I can guess what you're going to say, but I'll ask it anyway. Hiram, to you first, real quickly. So 50 years from now, are we still talking about this? Are we still arguing about church and state, or have we figured it out?
I'm hopeful that that we can figure it out. I think we have seen what I call the sort of the beginning of the golden age of sanity taking root. We have the Supreme Court saying it's okay to have the cross, Veterans Memorial, out in the middle of the Mojave Desert. We have the Supreme Court clamping down on some of these crazy Establishment Clause lawsuits, saying that you have to have real standing, you have to have a real injury, intentionally being offended is not necessarily going to be enough. There are a lot of progress being made, and I think we have a Supreme Court that recognizes that religious liberty is an inherent part of our American way of life and an important concept to preserve for the future. So I think the future is bright for religious liberty.
Barry, what do you think?
I thought just moments ago Hiram was suggesting that these unelected judges were making terrible decisions. Now they're making good decisions. They're just nine guys. They're ideologically driven.
Guys and gals.
Yeah, I mean, look, guys and gals, absolutely, and they're still ideologically driven. A golden age of sanity? I don't think so. We're still in a bronze age, you know, to use some kind of archaeological reference. I think we're going to still be fighting about this. Why? Because, as I said at the beginning of the show, these issues, do you believe in God? Is there a purpose to the universe? These are the biggest questions out there for most people, and whatever direction you come down on it, it informs your life. And as long as it informs your life, it's going to continue to be litigated, argued in every venue you can find, from the courts to your neighbor's fence.
Well, both of you, thank you very much for coming in. Hiram Sasser, thanks a lot for taking the time for us this morning.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Hiram Sasser, Director of Litigation for Liberty Institute. Barry Lynn, it was nice to meet you. Thank you for being
here.
Nice
to be here. Thank you.
Barry Lynn, Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, we sit down with New Hampshire Governor John Lynch as he prepares to leave the state's corner office. We'll look back with him at his achievements, his challenges, and what advice he'd impart to Governor-elect Maggie Hassan. Our broadcast is in partnership with New Hampshire Public Television. Email us your questions for Governor Lynch to exchange@nhpr.org, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 o'clock on NHPR, where